Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we open with CNN's John King and a judge's decision on the NSA, John Boehner's outburst, and whether the botched Obamacare rollout makes immigration reform far more difficult to achieve. Then a medical ethicist joins us to discuss drug companies paying doctors to promote their products. And we invite you in on the issue of the day: what to do with people and businesses who leave snow and ice on their sidewalks in New England.
Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on American trends: staying put, making multi-generational homes, haggling over prices, and getting deals even at big box stores. Then Shira Springer on the Heisman Trophy winner with a sexual assault charge hanging over his head, and fear and loathing at sporting events, tailgater brawls, and what happens if the 300-pound drunk guy at Gillette falls on top of you and your kids? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So when the Senate signs off on a budget deal later this week, will lawmakers leave coal or sugar plums in America's stockings? And sticking with the Christmas theme, if the NSA knows when you are sleeping and knows when you're awake, is that unconstitutional? Well, one federal judge seems to think it is. Joining us to go over these headlines, among other national news stories, is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. Hello there, John.
Happy noontime. How are you today?
Hey, to John. You. How's your shopping going?
Oh, yeah. I have to start that, don't I?
Yeah.
I'm a deadline guy.
Okay. So as Jim just said, John, this is a big deal. This federal judge on Monday saying the NSA program collecting all this information on everybody's telephones is likely unconstitutional violation of unreasonable searches and seizures. And as people know, other judges have ruled just the opposite. So this is a big, huge deal. I mean, he's issued a preliminary injunction for this one guy that brought the suit. What's going to happen here?
This is a tough one. Legally, the administration can get a stay and essentially keep doing what it's doing. But here's the president, in the face of rising doubt, skepticism, and opposition to this practice, is going to have to defend it in court as it makes its way up. Look, there's no doubt this one's going to make it to the Supreme, so we just don't know when. There's been other cases, as you noted. And so the president will be in court defending the policy, defending the NSA's right to do this, while at the same time he's promising some changes. Now, we don't know what those changes are going to be, what the scope of them is going to be. And today he's getting an earful from some of these technology executives, like the Yahoo CEO and the Google CEO, because they think they've been burned. They think they've cooperated with the government. But that the government has abused that right and that privilege. This is a tough one for the president. The court ruling is a bit of a legal ticket for him, but it also really emboldens the people on Capitol Hill. And it's a very interesting coalition of liberals and libertarians who say it's time to have major changes here. So you'll have this playing out in the court, and you'll have it playing out in Congress.
By the way, if people didn't actually hear what the judge said, it's worth reading how strong. And this is an appointee of George W. Bush, by the way. I cannot imagine a more indiscriminate and arbitrary invasion than the systematic and high-tech collection and retention of personal data on virtually every single citizen for purposes of querying it and analyzing it without judicial approval. John, you mentioned giving some power to people in the legislature. As I think we discussed last week, the House vote to only allow the NSA to snoop on people when they had reasonable suspicion they were involved in something only lost 217 to 205, I think earlier this year it was. That's only a 6-vote swing. So is it possible the Supreme Court case may ultimately be moot, that the Congress may act beforehand?
I think Congress may act before, and I think Congress may act next year. We likened this, I think, in our conversation last week, and the judge didn't choose my metaphor, but I think he essentially agrees that, they're throwing this giant net in the water to catch a minnow. And so they bring up a lot of other things that's none of their business, so that they have no legal right or no, reasonable cause to look at. That's what this judge is saying. Now, another judge may overturn that, as they go up through the appeals process. But in any event, I do think there's no question Congress is coming back to this because, again, you have the liberals who for a long time have opposed this but haven't felt they had any right to speak publicly because so much of it is classified, the Ron Wyden and the Udalls on the Democratic side. But now you have the Rand Pauls and the Marco Rubios and the Ted Cruzes who are looking at 2016 as well. So they have a policy point they want to make there, and they also have presidential ambitions. I don't think there's any doubt that this is going to cause Congress to come back at this again. We're at an interesting moment. You know, once 9/11 happened, 9/11 became on the terrorism environment what crime was. You know, after the Dukakis campaign, remember all the Democrats had to be tough on crime after Dukakis
sure.
and Clinton, and all that. After 9/11, you had to be tough on terrorism. I actually think we're at that point again where the American people are saying, whoa. And I think it's good for the country, actually. In 2014 congressional races and in the 2016 presidential primaries, let's have people talking about, you know, 12 years, 13 years after 9/11, what should we dial back? What should we keep? What do we have to tweak? Where has the government, maybe for good reasons at the beginning, but gone too far? I think it's a great conversation for the country to have.
You know, even if it turns out ultimately a higher court overturns this judge's interpretation of the law in the Fourth Amendment, his fact-finding is also critical to this national debate. The judge in this case said there was little evidence that the program, meaning the NSA's program, had actually prevented terrorism. The argument always had been, well, I know this may be a bit overly intrusive, but aren't you willing to give up a little of your privacy rights to ensure that you are safe? Well, this judge, at least, is finding that it didn't make us any safer, which sort of cuts out the underpinnings of the argument of the pro-NSA forces, it seems to me.
Right. It contradicts what, the leaders of the agency and everybody at the White House have publicly said. And so, again, there's this factual challenge. There's the role of government question. And now there's a credibility challenge. And this is what has changed the dynamic in Congress. When you see people like, you know, Dianne Feinstein, the chairwoman of the Intelligence Committee, who has supported this stuff almost carte blanche since, 9/11, saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure these guys are telling me the truth. You know, I'm in charge of oversight, and I ask these guys for answers, and they tell me this is what we're doing. And then I see either from some Edward Snowden leak or some evidence filed in a court case that that's not it, that, how they described it to her is not actually what's happening in practice. This has been sort of the trap door that's opened this politically, because the people in Congress are starting to think they're getting a little snookered and that they're not being told the truth. And I'll add this to it. When you have a president who's hovering around 40%, that impacts it too, because people, including more and more Democrats, are much more willing and open about challenging their own president.
We're talking with John King from CNN, their chief national correspondent. There's another twist, of course, in this whole NSA thing, with news that some of the officials from NSA are actually considering allowing Edward Snowden, who's been in Russia, amnesty in exchange for extensive documents that he's taken from the agency. The State Department doesn't like this, but apparently some officials within the NSA do. So he could be coming back to America.
Yeah, it'd be really hard for me to see the president signing off on this. But what does that tell you? It tells you the people in the NSA, the people whose credibility is being questioned, the people whose the practices of what they're doing and the scope of what they're doing, the constitutionality of what they're doing is being questioned. This is like Bill Belichick finding out that somebody stole the playbook. And I'm not, I know Jim's saying, oh, there he goes, sneaking in sports again.
There he goes again.
This is like the NSA is freaked out that this guy's got their playbook. He's got their map. He can tell more about what they're doing at a time when they keep saying, here's what we're doing. And then a week later or a month later, we find out that wasn't exactly true or it wasn't completely contextual. Edward Snowden's got more. And so then they say something else and he leaks another document. And they say something else and he leaks another document. So they want it back and they're willing to pay the high price, amnesty, to get it back. You can understand their politics, if you will. But it'd be very hard to see the State Department or the White House sign off on that. Think about the president, essentially saying, come on back.
John, one last NSA thing, and to continue the imagery, I want you to tell me when the quarterback, for lack of a better expression, of the State Department, otherwise known as John Kerry, goes to Brazil. NPR at the top of this hour just spoke yet again about the fact that Brazil is not that crazy about us at the moment because the NSA was monitoring her cell phone calls. This is the president of Brazil monitoring her cell phone calls. I mean this sincerely. When someone like John Kerry sits down with either his equivalent in Brazil or the president of Brazil, what do they say to these people? It's one thing to monitor phone calls of people who may be involved in terror. What do you say to Angela Merkel from Germany? What do you say to the president of Brazil? What do they say?
My Portuguese isn't so good, but what's I'm really, really sorry.
Really, really sorry.
Yeah. You could try to spin it and say, this is proof Brazil is rising on the world stage. Treat you just like Germany. You know, we treat you like an economic powerhouse. Look, this is hard. You saw the president at the Mandela Memorial hug the president of Brazil and have a brief, pass by. Not the place to do business, obviously. As they used to say in the great program, Lucy, I Love Lucy, they've got some splendid to do.
Yes, they do.
And it's hard. And it's hard because it complicates, we're making light of this, but it's actually an incredibly important economic relationship. It can be at times an incredibly important security relationship, not so much from a military perspective, but when you look at, the changes that are happening in Latin and Central and South America, when you look at how, the economics, the world economics over the next generation are increasingly going to be Pacific-based, not just Asia-Pacific, but also, the Pacific closer to home here in this hemisphere. So it's an incredibly important relationship. And look, all governments know other governments spy on them. That's not a great secret. But it's the public disclosure of this and the depth of it and the personal nature of the leader's cell phone that, guess what? Some of them are exaggerating this back home, but it's a great political item for them to say, I'm kicking the United States in the teeth. It's good for their politics.
John, last week when we spoke, I asked you something like, do you think that this modest deal between Patty Murray, the liberal Democratic senator, and Paul Ryan, the rather conservative House budget chair, was a breaking of the ice? And I think you said something like, maybe something, but not huge. Let me play some sound for you and ask you if this is an even more significant potential break. This is John Boehner last week responding to some of the more extreme elements of his own party.
They pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare and to shut down the government. Most of you know, my members know, that wasn't exactly the strategy that I had in mind. But if you'll recall, the day before the government reopened, one of these groups stood up and said, well, we never really thought it would work. Are you kidding me?
That was one of the great moments, and I love those moments, whether they're Democrats or Republicans who stand up to some of their own extreme elements. Is that a one-day blip, or is this going to affect how John Boehner proceeds through at least 2014?
No, I think this has already had an impact, and you see today they got, 67 votes for cloture in the Senate on this budget compromise. More and more conservatives decided, even though they know these Tea Party groups and these other, conservative Tea Party-like groups are going to go after them, more and more, not a waterfall of them yet, but a bigger trickle, have decided, we're going to vote for this. We're going to be governing conservatives, not opposition conservatives. We're going to say that this is actually, it ain't a great deal, but it's a better deal than nothing. And I think that's in part because Speaker Boehner, that remark he just played was essentially, I tried it your way and we got screwed. I'm not trying it your way anymore. That's what he's saying. And I think it's an interesting moment. Now, he's going to face heat over this. He's personally safe back home. And we won't know some of the long-term impact of this until we see some of these primary challenges next year against some of his House members, against some pretty big names in the United States Senate by these guys. But essentially, Boehner, this was a bottled-up internal Republican conversation. He finally said, I'm fed up with this. And I'm going to stand up and say, you guys are hurting the cause, and you're not real. You're just trying to raise money. It's an interesting play on his part. It's a risky play on his part. But I've known him a long time, and he is, again, whether you agree or disagree with his politics, he believes in conservative government, but he believes in the government part of it. These people opposing him, they think the Republican Party's role is to just fight everything Obama does. And John Boehner says, look at the Constitution. I have this title called Speaker. I'm kind of in line here. I have an important job. If we have these titles, we're supposed to use them and be responsible partners in government.
We're talking with CNN's John King. John, I hate to get ahead of myself, but I can't resist the 2016 speculation because, of course, Congressman Paul Ryan, he was the vice presidential nominee last time around. He's forged this compromise, even though it's a modest compromise with Patty Murray. And he's doing quite well in Iowa. What does this mean, if anything, at all? I mean, I know we're a long way away, but he does look a little bit more statesmanlike.
I think for the most part, the Iowa poll, he has the highest approval rating when you run through the list. I think that's mostly name recognition. He's a Midwesterner. He's from, a neighboring state. He spent a lot of time out there. Mitt Romney used him when they were targeting Iowa. He spent a ton of time there. And you have a very conservative part of the Iowa Republican Party, but you also have a, you know, more, I'll call it pragmatic, old Jim Leach was a guy, or Terry Branstad, the current governor, who are not, you know, reflexive ideologues. They're conservatives, but they believe, again, they believe in government. Look, I think this is healthy for the Republican Party. You have a party that's gotten its butt kicked in the last couple of presidential elections. It's searching for its soul and its leader. And part of this, part of that is, who are we? And Paul Ryan is somebody who, like John Boehner, says, you know, I got elected to do a job. And sometimes your job is to cut the best deal you can and then come back and try to cut a better one tomorrow. And there will be the Ted Cruz's, maybe in the same debates in Iowa, saying, no, your job was to say no and lie in front of the train and block the train and cut the tracks if you have to, you know, and do anything to stop this. That's a good debate for a party to have. You know, how long will the Republicans be in the wilderness? I don't know. Will Ryan run? That's a big question. I think that Iowa poll will encourage him to run. There are some people who think that, you know, he got a little bit of a sour taste of presidential politics and that he may stay in the House and hope to succeed John Boehner as the speaker. But it is part of the, there's a huge debate in the Republican Party. Are we governing conservatives? Do we have a responsibility to try to partner with Obama for the next 3 years and then try to take the White House? Or are we just an opposition party? And it's a great debate in the party. And I think the more that it's aired publicly as opposed to privately helps voters, whether you're Democrat, Republican, or independent, sort of just sort it out in your own mind.
You just asked, will Ryan run? Let's ask a corollary question. Will Brown run? Bloomberg has a story this morning. There were stories here a couple of weeks ago that Scott Brown was selling his home in Rentham. Bloomberg's reporting this morning, and others are as well, that the house is about to close. And they state, based on, there's no foundation for it, but they do state that he is moving to New Hampshire. One, do you know anything about that? Because we don't. And if he is, what are the odds in Washington on Brown challenging Jeanne Shaheen? He's actually speaking at a big dinner there, I think, on the 19th, yet again. What are the odds in Washington on Brown getting back into the fray?
I don't know the absolutes on the move to New Hampshire, but I talked to somebody close to him the other day who said that they were, you know, 99% sure that it was going to happen.
Was going to happen.
Was going to happen. That every indication was that he was he thought this was the right thing to do for him politically. Now, that's somebody here. It's not, you know, I said once the last time you talked to him, and of course said, you know, not that long ago, and I'm talking to people near him. So, you know, it's a funny business, and some people are trying to encourage him. You can be sure some of the consultants want him to do it because they want jobs on a race. And so you have to be a little careful about these things. However, again, you know, he's a man without a home at the moment in the sense of where he wants to run politically. There are a lot of people who think, given the environment, the Obamacare environment, the 2014 six-year itch environment, that Shaheen is potentially vulnerable. So then the question is, do you run a conservative? You know, we've talked before about this. Bob Smith says he might come back to New Hampshire and run, a very conservative senator. Do you run more of a, you know, moderate independent type like a Scott Brown? In a general election, you know, at least today on paper, you would think a guy who, you know, has more moderate views has a chance of taking away some Shaheen voters who might just be, you know, independents who went for Shaheen. So it would be an interesting race if he does it. He'll get called a carpetbagger and everything else. But, you know, they called Bobby Kennedy a carpetbagger. They called Hillary Clinton a carpetbagger. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
Well, you know, I heard occasionally I do watch a cable station that's not CNN. This morning I was watching a Morning Joe and I saw David Axelrod. I'm sorry. David Axelrod, who, of course, was the guru to Obama in her first election. He said, and I'm curious what your reaction was to this, that we're all assuming that Scott Brown would run against Jeanne Shaheen. But he said that New Hampshire is much different from Massachusetts. That's fairly obvious. And that the Rhino charges, Republican in name only, would come out immediately. And it's possible that Scott Brown, with all his political appeal and charisma and everything else, could be beaten in a primary by a conservative Republican. What do you think of that?
Sure. Of course he could be. As I just said, I think he'd probably be potentially a stronger general election candidate because he can reach out to the middle. And, you know, you guys know this as well or better than I do because you're still there. But, you know, in southern New Hampshire, you know, people just across the border, they tend to be more moderate. They're more probably, you know, they're more independents than anything else registered-wise in the state of New Hampshire. And there are people who maybe on some of the social issues or some other issues in a general election, Brown might be able to get them. But first, you got to win a primary. Primaries are about ideology. And there's a, you know, it's not a huge movement, but there's a pretty robust and active Tea Party group in New Hampshire. There are people who would say, you're not one of us. You know, you're trying to impose yourself on our state. We've got our own candidate who's been here for 10 years or 20 years or whatever. The primary would be the challenge. The biggest challenge would be to get to the primary, to get to the general election. Don't count out, you know, Christine Shaheen. She's a former governor. She won the Senate seat. There are a lot of times when people say, oh, she's not going to win, and she tends to win. But, yeah, I think without a doubt, there would be a, he would have to go through a primary. And, again, that's the same thing we're talking about when it's, whether it's in the state of New Hampshire or nationally, the Republican Party's going through this soul searching. Who do we want to be? And it'll be different from state to state.
Yeah.
It would be fun to watch.
Hey, John, last thing for me. Speaking of Scott Brown, and, of course, he was running as the 41st vote to stop Obamacare, there are a number of websites, Politico amongst them, who are suggesting that the failures of the rollout of Obamacare is going to do great damage to the potential of immigration reform in early 2014. The argument going, if you can't handle a website, how can you, quote, process millions of people here illegally, which would be part of this more comprehensive thing. I know you thought the chances of a broad bill succeeding were on the decline anyway because of the midterm elections. Is it legit to say that even some people who are leaning towards comprehensive reform are worried about that contention? People like Lindsey Graham, for example?
I would be a little less specific and just say, look at all the polling data, and I pick this up anecdotally, whether it's talking to members of Congress or, more importantly, talking to people when you travel in the country, and especially young people. And this is a threat for the president and an opening for the Republican Party, a lack of belief that the government can do anything right, just a declining belief that the government is organized and that in some polling, specifically, that this administration and this president are competently pulling the levers of government. And so when you're talking about a big program, whether it's immigration, whether it's health care, whether it's anything, you're talking about government. You're talking about some kind of regulation or processing, a new bureaucracy or reforming a bureaucracy. And when people's most recent experience is, forgive me, but the government would screw up a free lunch, it does make it harder. But because you're asking people to make big changes on an emotional issue that plays out, again, differently in whichever piece of the 50-state puzzle you want to pick. It's a different conversation in different places because of the economy, because of the demographics, because of the history, because of the political leadership. Yeah, sure. It's an added, how big of a factor, and does it fade with time if the Obamacare rollout, if phase two or phase three, wherever we are, is better, does it fade some? But it's a hard issue anyway, and this growing belief that government can't do things right, can't do things competently, absolutely affects a debate like that.
Now, before you go, John King from CNN, there's been a big controversy over at Fox News involving Megyn Kelly's pronouncement that Santa Claus is white. I wondered if you or Wolf Blitzer may be doing an investigative report on this on CNN anytime soon that we should look forward to?
I think Wolf Blitzer is Santa Claus. I mean, you just blew our big secret. We hide him 364
days
a year. We hide Wolf Blitzer there, and then he goes up to the elves, and Marjorie, you just blew the lid. Sorry, kids.
Okay. Good. Well, I think he'd make a good one with a little extra paunch there in the belly.
I'm. You know what? I know that Megan has tried to explain what she meant, and she thinks some of the critics are wrong. I'm going to stay out of this one. Santa Claus is a wonderful individual who brings holiday cheer to everybody. Everybody.
Hey, you better go shopping, John. So we'll let you go.
Thank you very much.
And if Santa can play tight end, he should go to Foxborough.
Got that baby in there too.
They need one. Poor Tom Brady kind of lost his cool at the press conference this week, didn't he?
He's entitled.
He's entitled.
Take care, John. It's great to talk to you.
Leaders lead. It was good that he blew his top. All right, guys. Take care.
John King, thank you very much for being with us as always. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. When we come back, we're going to look at Big Pharma's decision to dissolve its quid pro quo with doctors and what that's really all about. That conversation is next with Art Kaplan and 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And you'll never see a doctor saying, I'm not a salesman, but I play one on TV. But a lot of docs do fulfill that role, pushing certain drugs on behalf of pharmaceutical companies. For decades, Big Pharma, as it's called, has paid doctors to serve as a kind of spokesperson at medical conferences, and doctors will often prescribe these drugs for their patients. Well, one pharmaceutical company is calling it quits. GlaxoSmithKline will no longer pay doctors to promote its products. If our other similar companies follow, how could this change the way doctors diagnose and treat their patients. Joining us on the line to go over this and a ton of other medical ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, good to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, when I read this piece in the New York Times this morning saying GlaxoSmithKline no longer pay docs to promote its products, will stop tying compensation of sales reps to the number of prescriptions doctors write, my initial reaction is, that's great. And then my second reaction is, wait a second, does the average patient know that their doctor is getting paid based upon, some of the doctors are getting paid based upon the number of times they prescribe a specific drug? Do they know that?
Yes, it's great, and no, they don't.
And does the doctor have an obligation to tell, oh, by the way, this drug, which I personally, based on my medical experience, think is best for you, I should also say to you, I'm getting a little bonus because I am prescribing this. Don't they have that obligation?
Well, historically, they should have been doing that. It rarely happened. And the pharmaceutical industry has a sales force, believe this or not, one rep for every doc in the world. So it's a one-to-one ratio. That's how important getting drug reps in to see the doc, giving them free tickets, bringing them the donuts, offering them the opportunity to go to meetings to hear about the product. It was the core of marketing. Get the doctor on board your drug. If you didn't pay him literally, you know, a bribe, then give them in-kind gifts, offer them trips. Some doctors actually got hired to shill for the drugs by giving talks, which were not inaccurate, but they only talked about the pharmaceutical company's drug, didn't talk about a generic or the competition. It's been an awful, rotten, unethical world of marketing, in my view, and I'm really glad to see it end.
Well, a couple of things. One, I think Massachusetts already passed a law a couple of years ago disallowing the certain levels of gifts and those sort of things.
But that's right, and also requiring transparency that you had to register if you took money from a drug company.
Well, and that's my follow-up with you is, I'm assuming, I don't mean to be cynical, but GlaxoSmithKline is not just didn't have an epiphany in the middle of the night and decide to do the right thing. One, the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is requiring a similar sort of transparency. Is that what did it? Or does the fact that they're subject to this bribery investigation in China, where, according to the Times, quote, authorities contend the company funneled illegal payments to doctors and government officials to lift drug sales, which motivated them? One, both, neither, what?
I think both a little bit, but I think there's a third factor.
What's that?
Direct-to-consumer advertising on television and in social media. So now we watch football games, and they've turned into kind of drug emporium advertising events, right? Ask your doctor about this. You got a little itch there.
That's so true.
Get this fixed. They know that they can market with a fair degree of efficacy, not to the doc, but to you and me. I happen to think that also is bad public policy. I think that direct-to-consumer marketing on radio, TV, social media, you don't really know what they're talking about. They're only telling you about their name brand drug. They don't tell you about the competition. All the sins that we saw in doctor-oriented marketing are being played out in advertising directly to consumers. And by the way, we're one of two countries in the world, New Zealand's the other one, that allows it. No one else lets it happen. And I think that's why, if you really said to me, why are they doing this, I think it's because they've got a substitute that's very effective.
Well, you know what kills me? I'm so glad you mentioned the whole thing when you watch athletic football games, whatever it is. It's a long one commercial after another of all these ailments. And so many times they say, are you tired? Are you run down? Are you feeling blue? And yeah, you are, because you haven't slept much.
Oh, I thought you were asking me, yeah.
Exactly. Maybe you're tired. Maybe your holiday shopping hasn't gone the way it should. Maybe your kids are driving you nuts. And those are all the symptoms. But instead, it's pushing this pill to solve the problems, which have nothing to do with a real medical problem. They're to do with your circumstances. And it really is horrifying when you get to the end of these commercials. Then they list all the possible, this can kill you, side effects. And yet people obviously go out and buy these drugs.
They ask the doctor, and, you know, doctors are under pressure. Time is being pinched for a lot of the primary care people. You don't want to get into a huge argument with your patient, so it's too easy to write the prescription often. We've seen that with some of the psychiatric medications and some of the anxiety-reducing things. A lot of parents come in and want something for their kid who's acting up a bit. That's turned into a big business. So Yeah, you know, you get the, we sometimes call it disease mongering.
Yeah.
Feeling a little nasty before your next menstrual cycle.
Exactly. You want to kill
your husband? Are you talking to me, Art?
Exactly.
No, we're just victims of this pernicious emotional onslaught premenstrual cycle. But, you know, there are tons of these things. It's interesting even to see in the erectile dysfunction space. It used to be for people who really had a problem, a real disease, but now it's spreading out to people who might not perform as well as they wish or something like that.
Yeah, so, exactly. And you're starting at 18 with these
erections. Exactly. So you can see this disease creep
right.
to try and market. But to come full circle back to Jim's question, if you really ask me, I think direct-to-consumer advertising budgets have shown to be just about as powerful as marketing to the doc, and I think that's where we're getting the shift. I'm not against the shift. I think it's overdue to get the docs out of the marketing game, but something else is out there, and it's your television set.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. I mean, this is the next part we're going to move into is really a continuation of a theme, because there's been this two-decade very successful campaign, again, by pharmaceutical companies to push pills to deal with ADHD or attention deficit disorder. And there's another story just from a couple of days ago also in the Times talking about, on the one hand, it's a good thing, because if you had these kids that were very hyperactive and misbehaving, and people thought that they had terrible, that they were just bad kids. Now we know that some of them, anyway, have a neurological problem. But the numbers show that the diagnosis of ADHD has been made in 15% of high school age kids, and the number of kids on this medication has soared from to 3.5 million from only a little over half a million in 1990. So is this another pharmaceutically created exaggeration, Art Kaplan?
I think it is. I think the best evidence about the problem with ADHD is that, and I do recognize that there is a core set of kids who probably do have something that can be helped by a drug that lets them learn and focus and pay attention. I'm not saying it doesn't exist at all, but I don't think it was in the article, but the difference between our rates and Germany and European comparable countries, we're like ADHD at four times everybody else's rate. So I know we're easy to divert as in terms of our attention span, but it ain't four times Germany, and it's not four times Italy and so forth. Those numbers alone tell you that not only is it advertising and pharma-driven, they go to where the prices and the profits are the best, and that's the U.S. The Europeans just don't spend the same amount of money. Their prices are lower. Their governments negotiate the prices. You make the biggest bucks here. That's why we have the most disease here.
You know, so far, this is pity the poor patient. This is so your doctor may be taking money to prescribe this, but it's likely you don't know. Your doctor prescribed ADHD medication for your kid, but you're not really sure if he or she needs it. And then tie that to what, last 24 hours, the Annals of Internal Medicine, quote, "The message is simple. Most vitamin supplements do not prevent chronic disease or death. Their use is not justified, and they should be avoided." On the same day, the FDA is saying all these antibacterial soaps don't work better than non-antibacterial, and in fact, they may hurt you. And so how does the average person
I just want to chime in and say, ain't it a good time to be an ethicist?
I'm serious. How does the average person sitting at home who wants to make sure that they take care of themselves, their family, their kids, etc., how do they sort through all this and still go to work and do what they got to do?
Well, let's remember, looking at financial conflict of interest and asking about it is important. Those people pushing supplements, and by the way, Dr. Oz does it. It's on TV. It's all over the place, both vitamins and supplement stuff, for which the average person has a diet that doesn't require any of this kind of stuff, and some of which is manufactured under circumstances that may make things unsafe in terms of getting what you think is in the bottle. A lot of docs are selling this stuff. That's my point. If the doctor sells it, the doctor prescribes it, and the doctor says, hey, you know, I happen to have a shelf full of this stuff right here. You can buy it for me. I'm suspicious.
It's but most of us, I know you hear this all the time. I totally agree with you intellectually, but most of us are so intimidated. I have wonderful doctors, and I love them, and they treat me incredibly respectfully. But there's a something, there's a magic or something that causes intimidation. And as you're speaking, I'm trying to imagine speaking to one of my doctors and saying, "Hey, doc, are you getting money from that company?"
Yeah.
I can't even imagine the words ever crossing my lips.
Please, you're not shy.
It's not the best way to build a nice, friendly, trusting relationship when you start off saying, "Hey, by the way, before we start, how about you give me a disclosure of all your investments, income sources, and so on?" We want to trust in our healers, and we want to have a little magical feeling about them, and I sympathize with that. So the way to deal with this is not in the doctor-patient relationship. It's to prohibit the marketing direct-to-consumer right. as public policy. It's to have the drug companies pull back the sales force as public policy. It's to make sure that the supplements and all the rest of that mumbo-jumbo stuff that's out there, that the advertising, I like what the FDA is doing, and I wish the Federal Trade Commission would do it too, is saying prove that antibacterial claim. Prove that there's a health benefit from taking bees pollen or whatever it is. We can't do it in terms of me and the doc. It's not going to work there. It's too accusatory. It sounds like an episode of, you know, some kind of legal show. That isn't going to be the place to do it. I myself won't do it. I won't do it either. I'm not going to go in there and start grilling my doctors about their financial holdings. So it has to take place higher up the chain. Right. That's my point.
You know, we have this really scary story being documented up here in the Boston Globe involving Children's Hospital, where a 15-year-old girl who had been treated at Tufts Medical Center in Boston for quite some time by something called mitochondrial disease. I guess mm-hmm. it's a metabolic disease, affects how cells produce energy and stuff like that. Her parents, the young woman, Justine, is not doing well. The Tufts doctor had recommended she see a specialist at Children's Hospital. When she's really, you know, not walking and not eating and very bad, they take her to Children's Hospital. And Children's Hospital apparently disagrees with this diagnosis from Tufts, thinks that this young woman has psychiatric problems and not this metabolic disease. This happened last winter. It is now almost a year, and this young woman has been, or young girl, I should say, has been in the locked psychiatric ward at Children's Hospital for almost a year, and the hospital only allows her to see her parents once a week for an hour. They're now in a custody fight before the courts. But I read this, and I thought, and by the way, it's not the only case at Children's Hospital. This is just the most extreme one. What it comes down to, it seems to me, is a different diagnosis among doctors, and in this case, two hospitals. And Children's Hospital has taken essential custody, the state technically, but the Children's Hospital has pushed the state to take custody of this kid.
Well, in general, that's a very miserable story.
Miserable.
Don't like to hear that. You don't want to push parents out of the picture by medical authority. That should only happen with thorough judicial legal review. The hospital should be in court basically saying, here's why the parents are a danger, or here's why the family environment is a danger. Sometimes it is. I've seen it. But in general, you don't want to do it just on medical authority alone. Parents have primacy of rights vis-a-vis their kids. Those diagnoses, when you get fatigue and tiredness and many things, they're tough to make. I know that. Some people think they're psychiatric. Some people think they may be biological in the way you were describing. They're difficult. We don't understand them very well. But bottom line, only a judge should be able to push parents away from their kids, and they better have a darn good reason to do so. I don't like the sound of the narrative that's evolved up there.
Well, you know, also from my reading of this, I assume what this is going to be is one of those religious things where, you know, the parents mm-hmm. say, "I'm sorry, mm-hmm. we believe our God doesn't want this kind of treatment." And even then, a court should intervene unless there's immediate emergency. This is not this. What makes this even more egregious is it seems by my reading, and Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, is this is a dispute between doctors where the parents are relying on the recommendation of one set of doctors. It isn't like they've come up with some quackery, which Children's Hospital rejects, which to me makes the seizure of the kid unilaterally even more unconscionable.
I mean, I agree. And look, the only way you can unilaterally act is if you have a proven diagnosis with a proven remedy. So if you have diabetes and your parents are saying no for whatever reason, and you know insulin's going to work, you can get a judge to issue that order and administer that insulin or the antibiotic. There are, or the blood transfusion with a Jehovah's Witness. There are classic cases of this, and I've done it. But when you have doctors fighting, no agreed upon diagnosis, uncertain treatment, you should not be able to separate the kid from the parents, to isolate them without a complete and thorough judicial review. If that's happened, that's just flat out wrong.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. I mean, they're in the juvenile court right now, and the parents did go to juvenile court. But one of the pieces, too,
has been separated from her parents because
the State Department of Children and Families, which does not have the expertise, obviously, to really go up against Children's Hospital and their team of physicians, agree with the hospital and said we're going to take this child away.
That's where I think you want the court faster.
Yeah, you want that court in there faster. But there's another factor here, too, which is clear in these stories, that the parents, the mother particularly, is kind of a pain in the neck to these doctors. She's disputing, you know, she's going from doctor to doctor to get different diagnoses, and she's giving them a hard time when she disagrees with them. You get the sense that they didn't like this mother.
Yeah.
And because
well, if you took kids away from every parent who's a pain in the neck, beginning with my mother, the doctors, you'd have a lot of orphans around the state of Massachusetts. So, it's not good enough. I do understand that parents can be trouble for their kids. I do understand parents can be trouble in dealing with the docs. But in this area that we're in, with vagueness about the diagnosis, uncertainty about what's going on with a kid, you got to operate with a fine-tuned instrument, not a hammer.
Let me ask you a two-pronged thing about this before we put this to rest, at least for now. And apparently there may be a judge's decision on the, I think, parents' petition as early as Friday, hopefully. Two things. One, how common is this sort of thing? Again, not with the Jehovah's Witness kind of thing, but with the medical dispute. And number two, one of our colleagues, after having read this story, said something to us, Marjorie and me, this would never have happened to me. And she didn't mean that arrogantly. She meant I'm an upper middle class person. This appears to be more of a working class family where a hospital feels that they are more able to take advantage of somebody. Is that your experience, and how frequently does this happen? It's not frequent, happily.
Yeah. Not frequent. Will people give the bum's rush to poorer, more disadvantaged, more illiterate parents? I'm going to say yeah. I think that the more empowered and franchised parents are more assertive about their rights, know where to go to grab a lawyer or to get other interventions from an ethics committee at the hospital and so forth. So, yeah, I do think there's some class differences here, too. But it isn't frequent, happily, no.
One last thing on this whole thing is that you hear this from parents a lot, where especially when you get into some kind of psychiatric realm, that they go in to see these specialists on the advice of their pediatrician, and the specialists are often like 30 years old, just got out of medical school, have a whole litany of degrees. And when there's psychiatric areas, you know, which are obviously much harder to diagnose, what the doctors say, even when they're seeing somebody for a half an hour, carries an awful lot of weight. And it's very scary to the parent who's with the kid 24/7 and has an insight which for class reasons or expertise reasons is often dismissed. I think a lot of people are afraid of those areas with especially involving psychiatric stuff.
Oh, you're making a great point. You know, the system is set up for quick intervention to save money. Here's a pill. We know what the diagnosis is. Don't need a long-term relationship and don't need a lot of talking. We built that system. Psychiatry didn't. Young psychiatrists didn't. You and I did politically, by saying, yeah, don't pay for long-term relationships in mental health. Go for the pill. Go for the quick fix. If we want to change that situation, it's up to you, me, listeners, the electorate, to say, you know what? We want a system that will reimburse for time. And it doesn't. We save money on mental health over the years by making it a quick fix approach. And I think we got to go back and look at that.
By the way, we should say Neil Swarty and Patty Nguyen, who was with us yesterday for something else, have written this two-part series in The Globe, which is really worth reading. Before you go, Art, this morning I get up. I was about to take my multivitamin. I'm about to pop it in my mouth. I say, wait a second. I'm going to be talking to Art Kaplan in a couple of hours. So do I take the I'm relatively healthy. Do I take the multivitamin or do I not, Art?
I don't think you do, because I don't think the evidence is there, unless you got anemia or you got some kind of vitamin D deficiency that's been measured. 100. I don't think so.
I'm spitting that baby out right here.
We should be still.
I mean, you might take it. You know, if it's a Flintstone kind of thing, then.
I love those. Don't you love those, Art?
Chewables.
My favorite.
Art Kaplan, okay. It's great to talk to you.
Thank
as always.
Thank you so much, Art. I wish Art was my full-time doctor. I feel so much better about everything.
He's a medical ethicist.
I know, but I would ready to go for him for all my problems. Anyway, he's the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, again, great to talk to you. And Jim, I have to congratulate you that you are planning on taking an empowered step as a patient.
I am.
Or not a patient. You're boldly going to give up that multivitamin every day.
I am disgorging the multivitamin. That is correct, Margaret.
That's very good. What do you guys think about this whole thing, the sort of power imbalance between that many of us feel between our physician and ourselves? You know, a very common thing now when you go to the doctor is to bring in – you go to the – online, to Medical MD, you bring in what you read on Medical MD. They really seem to hate that. That's been my experience when you show up with the stuff from Medical MD. But how do you feel about challenging your physicians, getting a second opinion from your physicians, disagreeing with your physicians when they may be diagnosing?
Or even asking questions of your physicians.
Yeah, you can ask questions. 877-301-8970 is the number. 877-301-8970. And the email address is bpr@wgbh.org. I brought the stuff from medical, the MD online.
You've printed stuff out and taken it to the doctor?
I have.
And how's that gone?
She hated it.
Well, she hated it because she thought you were challenging her authority or it was quackery or what was the concern?
Well, I've told you this before, Jim. I don't think my doctor likes me very much.
Oh, it's that one. Well, then forget your story. Let me tell you mine. Virtually every single doctor with whom I deal, and as you know, I have quite a few in my little black book. As I said to Art, unbelievably respectful, unbelievably decent, are willing to give me time, all this kind of thing. I had minor surgery a couple of years ago, and I have to say, I've told you the story before. When I went in to say to a person who I had a very good relationship with that I wanted to get a second opinion before I had the surgery, I was literally breaking out in hives. I mean, and you know, I said to myself intellectually, this sort of extends the conversation we're having with Art. I said to myself intellectually, this is a totally reasonable thing to say. If I was buying a blender or buying a car, I would say, this, thank you very much. I'm going to look around. But the notion that I was about to say to this doctor, I totally trust you. I totally respect your opinion. But I want to get a second opinion before someone puts a knife in me or a scalpel in me. I was totally intimidated, not by them, just internally. And then I mentioned to you a few minutes ago, I was telling you and Chelsea, then when I decided to go to the other doctor and I had to make the phone call, I decided it was the grown-up thing to do. I wasn't just going to leave a message. I want to speak to the first doctor because I would want that to happen to me.
He's very grown up.
While he was fine about it, I was really anxious. So as Marjorie said, we want to know, how do you deal with this dynamic? If you have questions, if you've done independent research, if you want, I almost get nervous saying, if you want a second opinion and you don't, a lot of people just sneak around.
I do. That's
and you don't
I
even
do.
Say you're
I
getting a second.
I sneak around.
Do you do that? Is that
I went
true?
I went to one doctor for my foot surgery, which I had, and I didn't really like him. And he lives near me. Well, his office is near me. I would live in fear that he would see me on the street and ask me when I was coming in. And you know, I'd have to lie or tell him I was coming in soon, or you'd run into him at Whole Foods and it would be terrible.
But you know what's incredible about this thing is that and I know this is obvious, so I'll say it fairly quickly, and then you can give us a buzz at 877-301-8970. You have no problem getting a, quote, second opinion or a second price on something that doesn't matter. Again, like an air conditioner or something like this. But there's no more important decision you make than about the health care of yourself or your kid.
Right.
And there, I think, despite the fact that I am, as I said, totally intellectually get the importance of it, use the word challenge. I don't mean challenge. Ask questions. Go back and forth before you have something done to you or not done to you. It is amazing to me how intimidating it is, even if your doctor or nurse is not an intimidating presence. It's just it's the historical notion of, as you say, the power imbalance in that relationship. 877-301-8970. I'm hyperventilating just talking about this, and I'm not dealing with a doctor. Let's start with in Middletown, Rhode Island, where Erica is on Boston Public Radio. Erica, thanks for the call.
Hi.
Hi, Erica.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm 47 years old, and I've been challenging my doctor since I was a teenager.
Good for you.
With everything, any reason I needed to go. And whenever they'd look in the file, they'd say, oh, I see you don't like what we say and all that. And I think it's actually important to, I teach my kids to not believe everything the doctors say and to question what they're suggesting, and to take the diagnosis, let's say, and come home and evaluate what you want to do with it before you take any action.
But Erica, you sound like a totally confident person. I want to be like you. No, I'm serious. Is it hard to do what you've done your whole life?
Yeah, even when I started having kids, it's hard. It was hard again to speak up on their behalf, but I would get nervous a little bit, but it gets easier. And in a way, I think the doctors, if you do it the right way, they appreciate the collaboration in your health.
I hope.
Next
time I go back, I'm going to call you, Erica, and you can go with me.
I think Erica thanks for the call. Erica's probably got a big asterisk next to her name in the files of the doctor. Here
she
comes.
How do you like the doctor saying, one of the doctors saying to her, you're looking in the file, you're one of the people, you have a history of challenging us. Well, that's a real collegial kind of thing.
That's what part of this children's hospital thing is about, that this was an uppity mother, in their view, who was not disagreeing with their, who was not agreeing, rather, with their expertise.
How dare she?
And they got ticked. Exactly. How dare she? And you hear that a lot, frankly, in medicine when you offer a different theory.
But I'm not in that category. I have had a succession. I don't mean this is a joke, of unbelievably great doctors, specialists throughout my adult life. Mm-hmm. Virtually none of them were anything except terrific. And I still had problems with most of them. And by the way, the only time I was able to break through and do what Erica did is when they'd say something like, it appears to me, Jim, you have questions. Or do you have questions?
Maybe that's
or do you have concerns?
You are a big man.
I am a big man.
More of a sexist thing, too, where the nutty mother, the nutty mother is always lurking in the background. Some are doing something terrible to their kids. You hear that quite a bit. Claire from Somerville. Hi, Claire.
Hello, Claire.
Hi, good morning. Nice to hear this conversation happening this morning.
Good.
I'm a registered nurse, 30 years in the business. I've been doing elder care for as long as I can remember at this point. And so I come across this situation where the almighty MDs are making decisions that may or may not be in the best interest of my patients. And as a patient myself, I run into, don't be the naughty patient because they'll really get you. Well, they're not going to get me. It's my body. It's my right. And I get to choose. And that's the bottom line.
So what do you counsel, Claire, right now? Give advice to the anxious patient like me about how to, I don't even want to say stand up or challenge, but essentially create greater equality in your relationship with your doctor or nurse. What's the advice?
Well, I think you have to just go in knowing that nobody else but you can be the primary advocate and caretaker for yourself and your children.
But you know something, Claire?
It's not easy, but you do it.
What you said about the almighty MD, my sister-in-law has been a nurse forever at one of the best hospitals in Boston and told me over the years horror stories about her knowing that the doctor was making a mistake and how you have to finesse that because it, with the medication or with whatever it is, that there's a huge amount of resentment, especially when she's like a 30-year nurse and this is a 28-year-old resident or somebody right out of medical school. A lot of them don't say thank you for preventing me from making a mistake. They get mad.
How do you deal with that, Claire?
Really angry.
How do you deal
really
with
really angry?
Forget the patient. How do you deal with a doctor with whom you have disagreements about the care being given or the advice being given or the medication being given, a patient of both of yours?
Well, what I did this morning, quite frankly, is I just had a very unhappy hospitalization locally, and I wrote a letter to the billing department saying I wasn't going to pay my bill, and I sent a letter to my insurance company. I CC'd my insurance company. No, I'm not going to settle for substandard care.
Wow.
Claire, thank you for the call.
Maybe what you need to do, Jim, is go to nursing school and develop a spine along these lines. Let's go to Linda in Beverly. What do you think about the power and balance, Linda?
Hi, guys. I was very fortunate for about 30 years of my life. I had an awesome doctor in Mass General. He's since retired, but they have a center named after him. He was the type of a doctor who said, always question, always look at yourself. What are you doing different in your life? Write down things. He hardly ever prescribed medication. If you said to him, do I need something? He'd look at me and go, no, just change your lifestyle and we'd talk about it. It took me, after he retired and after I moved to the North Shore, it took me 10, 11 years. And I'm a massage therapist and a Reiki practitioner. took me over 10 years before I found a doctor that had respect for me as a alternative, complementary, preventative medicine person. And now I have a doctor like that. And when I see her, she blesses what I do. She says, "You make life easier for me. I love the fact that you take care of people." And she also likes the fact of how I take care of myself. She encourages me. I then encourage my clients. You have to question everybody, no matter who it is. Yeah, it's like reading the labels on food. You have to question. You have to reason what's best for you. It's common sense.
Hey, Linda, that's a great call. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. Do you hear the strength in the voices of all three of those women who just called?
You and I are wimps. No, that's the bottom line here.
But it's helpful. I mean, it is helpful to me. And when you compare it to all these other consumer things you do, like when Linda just mentioned, just like all of us now look at labels before we make a decision there. It's essentially it's looking at different at labels. And it's just people do have to be stronger.
Here's a helpful.
And by the way, if you have the kind of doctor, and I think most of them will not be resentful if you're honest and straightforward. If you have the kind of doctor who is resentful, then isn't it a fair statement to say that's not the kind of doctor you want to be taking care of you?
Well,
if he or she doesn't want you to be an equal participant in the relationship?
In this children's hospital story, you sent that there was some resentment among the doctors, that the children's hospital doctors did not like what the Tufts physicians said, and vice versa. We just got a very helpful email from Erin from Southbridge, who said she's stuck in traffic on Star Drive on her way to a bioethics meeting. And she recommends that both of us and the listeners read Jerome Groopman's book on how doctors think, which we might all find fascinating and helpful.
You know, in defense of doctors, and by the way, you know, I go to the annual, the State of the Union meeting for the Mass Medical Society every year.
Great.
They have been wonderful, and it's a wonderful bunch of people. Part of the problem is not in the doctor. Part of the problem is in the system. I told you the doctor I had for 20 years at Mount Auburn, whom I totally loved, left the profession. She since re-entered in a different way. The reason she left the profession is she couldn't deal with the notion that you had to see a patient every 6 minutes or 7 minutes or 12 minutes or whatever it was. And those kind of time and fiscal constraints, I would assume, cause otherwise totally compassionate, willing to listen people to be unable to do this kind of thing. So I don't think we should just keep heaping negativity on the doctor. They work within an insurance system that is, frankly, pathetic. Eric and Bolton, you're on with Marjorie and Jim on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hey, guys. I talked to you about 10 years ago, but my voice was very hoarse because I was screaming no discrimination in the Constitution at the State House when they were trying to pass same-sex marriage. I'm sure you remember me. Anyway,
we remember you well, of course, yes.
Great program this morning. And, Jim, I totally agree with what you just said. You know, there are a lot of doctors doing their best to do a great job in a hard system. And I've felt like you guys. I've often felt a wimp. It's been hard to speak up. But I think I'm getting I would be a little quicker to speak up for myself than I was in the past. I once, quite a few years ago in the winter, I let a cat into my house at night who was cold and saying, "Hey, it's freezing. Can I please come inside?" So I let him in. He slept with me. And then, slept with me non-sexually. I just let him. So
we understand.
Yeah, we get it.
Got it. Thank you for that qualification, Eric. Go ahead.
So anyway, then I had these weird bumps and, you know, geez, do I have a skin, you know, disorder? So I went to a doc that I hadn't been to before. You know, it turned out it was just fleas, but there was some specialist that was going to come in and evaluate me. And, you know, I get it. You know, it's funny because I happen to be a massage therapist and a Reiki practitioner myself. And I understand doctors don't have time to listen to all your problems and give you a massage. But this doctor literally did not introduce himself, did not say one word. He brought students in with him, and he was looking at my skin, evaluating me, talking to his students, literally did not say hello. And if that had been me today, I would have said, okay, note to students, introduce yourself to the patient. I'm now going to go file a complaint with the hospital. And that's what I would do.
Eric, what happened to you in recent how did you move from who you were to who you are today? Where did the strength – I'm serious. Where did all this come from, the assertiveness?
Well, I think from having negative experiences like that, I'm like, you know, this is ridiculous. This is unacceptable. And I think part of the fear that maybe comes up with wanting a second opinion or speaking up for ourselves is that we know we don't have the knowledge. So I think what we have to realize, and that's why we may be a little squeamish about it, because I know I don't have the medical knowledge necessary. So that's what maybe a little
Eric, I agree with that. But the role of the professional, of the doctor in this case, is to break it down so that it's consumable by the patient. Thanks for your call. I remember when I was a young lawyer, I mean, a lot of lawyers speak a different language purposely so that they're not challenged by their clients. If you're intimidated by the language and all that sort of stuff, then you don't intrude. You just allow the lawyer to make decisions for you when you're supposed to be the decision maker.
You know where you see a lot of activism along this is with pregnant women that are reading up and everybody's studying their pregnancy, and they opt not to go to physicians. They opt to do the midwife birth because they don't trust the doctors. They think that they're going to be rushing in with the first sign of medical intervention. They don't want to wind up with a cesarean section. Cesarean section rate is extremely high in the United States, and they want to have someone say to them things like, you know, who's going to help you with the baby after the baby's born? Do you have a washing machine because you're going to be washing a lot of baby's clothes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They want a more non-medical birth, and good for these women. I think it's great.
We'll squeeze in one more quick one if we can. Michelle, you're in the car. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. I just wanted to two things. One is, you know, recently I've been dealing with a lot of caregiving issues with my elderly parents. And two things. One is that I think that it's important to look at your physician as a professional. And I know that that's been mentioned a couple of times. But if you look, instead of reading a label, you think, well, you go to an accountant who, you know, studies hard and long and has special designations, a financial planner, an attorney, like you said. When you meet with those people, you do ask questions. They are professionals. They're providing you a service, and they need to, you know, you need to sit with them and just ask the questions. And just like them, it might be a bad time. You know, when we were going through some things with my dad, one of my sisters works in a medical environment. She has a million questions. She's kind of a little persnickety around that. And
love
so,
that word.
Well, I just went to the doctor and I said, hey, you know, my sister, she works in a medical environment. She's got, you know, she's medical lingo, and we'd all like to sit and meet with you. And so we scheduled a time. We sat together, and he sat and he said, you know, I'm going to go at a different, you know, kind of a rate and use language that's a little more specific because I understand, you know, in deference to my sister.
Yeah.
And they were just terrific. So I think that part of it is, you know, kind of look at the doctor as a professional. When can we speak? We have a lot of questions. We have a large family. We really need to understand this. And then, you know, I think they're very willing and able to accommodate you.
I hope most aren't. Hey, Michelle, thanks for the call. The connection's bad. You have a plan. She had a plan. She had a strategy,
so
a plan,
need,
and it
need,
sounds like that's key.
You need a strategy, Jim. That's the bottom line.
I'll give you one. You give me one. Is that a deal?
Okay. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Nancy Kane, historian from the Harvard Business School. We're going to talk about how the economy is changing the way Americans are living our lives. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The economy is changing the way we live. In many ways, we're turning back the clock. For example, housing prices are forcing some families to live together under one roof, and that includes grandma and grandpa. And it's also keeping us grounded, literally. Sluggish economy is keeping us from crossing state lines to take on that new job, if there is a new job. Joining us to go over how this is affecting how we live and who we are is Nancy Kane. As you know, Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey.
Hi, Nancy. Nancy, thanks for the Christmas goodies there, too. Okay, so we've always been big movers in the United States, moving from state to state, as Jim just said, and house to house and house to house. But we're the proportion of Americans moving has fallen to all-time low. So is this a good thing, a bad thing? What's it got to do with the economy?
So just, you know, to take the historian's prerogative, let's remember that, you know, what Carl Daigler, a grand old man of American history, once said, capitalism came in the first ships, right? We came from the old world, many, many capitalists and entrepreneurs. And once we got here, we didn't stay on the eastern seaboard, even though that's the first part of the country that developed. When we moved west to Pittsburgh, then to Chicago, which in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s was like Cappy's Liquors in Medford. All roads led to Chicago, right? And once we got to Chicago, we jumped further west, right? And then south. And then fast forward to the 20th century and the great migration to the auto industry in the 20s. And then the great migration west from the Dust Bowl to California. And then the great migration to the southwest, what we called, you know, the air conditioning belt. And so suddenly, perhaps suddenly is too strong, but over the last 2.5 decades, that kind of mobility has slowed dramatically. Now, I don't think that's about reduced restlessness in the American soul. I mean, we are a restless people. We are a rising and a restless people. I don't think it's about that. I think it's partly about the economy, and it's about shifts in the economy that are as great as those that occurred during the Great Depression. So people don't have, in a short-term way, don't necessarily have a new job to go to, right? We don't yet necessarily have, and this is the most, to me, worrisome or kind of, you know, most important thing to fret about, we don't necessarily have the next big gold rush, so to speak, whether it's literally a gold rush or it's, you know, the American auto industry in the 1930s or it's Silicon Valley or, you know, the 128 belt pulling people to it. So we don't have those kind of open greenfield opportunities. We may not be able to sell our house. We may not be able to get a mortgage to buy another house. There's a bunch of short-term things that seem to be keeping us, as the as this New York Times article by Annie Lowry says, keeping us staying put. But then there's some long-term things that I hadn't really thought about, but this article makes clear that I think are interesting. One is our labor market's getting a lot more similar across the country.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And, you know, is it the case that now we really are a service economy so that even manufacturing, which once used to be big draws, right, for mobility, whether it was, you know, going to the auto industry or whether it was going into high tech or whether it was going into steel in Pittsburgh in the 1860s, we don't necessarily have these dramatic regional differences in manufacturing. Indeed, one economist in this article cited says that, you know, a lot of manufacturing is now back office work anyway. So it's a service job, as so many jobs are. And there's not necessarily a big difference in work and a big difference across regions, states, counties, districts, in wages. So, you know, what does that smell like to me? It smells like the landscape, literally and metaphorically, of opportunity is changing in this country.
But is that a problem? I mean, other than the fact that one likes one's fellow men and women have as many choices about anything as they possibly can, should this development, this decline in mobility, should it bother us either economically or societally? Why should we care about this?
So, I mean, the kind of first, you know, line of defense or first line of reaction of economists, and it's a good one, is, well, this may indicate less mobility and nimbleness among the workforce. And, you know, American workforce historically has been noted for both those aspects, right? Not only its willingness to pick up and go, opportunity driven, but also its willingness to do that quickly and in, you know, in waves. So if that is in any kind of way a result here, that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing. It's not a good thing in a global economy where there's lots intensifying competition among nations. It's not a good thing, you know, kind of region by region for social mobility. It's not a good thing even in terms of our sense of ourself, right, of our collective sense of possibility. So I don't – if that is indeed what's happening, and I think the jury is out to a certain extent there, and there's a lot of theory and probably less kind of numerical practice involved in that reaction, then that's not a good thing. Now, pause for a second. I'm rereading Mansfield Park. So that's – just to reacquaint ourselves, that's in the middle of Jane Austen's kind of arc of novels. It's about a woman named Fanny Bryce who is quiet and passive and plays both consciously and unconsciously the moral center at a moment when society around her – this is the early 19th century in England – is losing its moral bearings. You could argue that we have some of those manifestations right now.
Right.
So is it a bad thing for people to stay put? The argument of Austen, I think it's a very, very powerful one, told brilliantly and in some cases sardonically, is that being still and being passive actually is somehow at times very necessary to a sense of solidity and moral purpose and keeping society on the right kind of ballast and as a ballast to, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah possibilities, which I see plenty of as well on this particular moment in December. That's neither here nor there. But in any case, I'm not so sure it's necessarily all told a bad thing that we're staying put.
Well,
first of all,
what you said a minute ago, being still and being passive, one can be still and not be passive.
Because
I was going to make the point, we hear, returning it to the most mundane, except for kids who go to UMass, I'm exaggerating this, but you know my point, except for kids who go to UMass where X percent stay in the state, other kids who are educated in the state get their education here and then they leave. That's unfortunate for Massachusetts, just picking as an example. Isn't stability a good thing?
Yeah, so,
and not only in terms of the economy, in terms of building relationships, building communities, all those kinds of things, as opposed to having this transitory thing that...
So that's where I was going.
Oh, sorry.
Highlight passivity from Austin and delete, because that part of Fannie Bryce isn't necessarily relevant here, but I think it is. You know, think of the stories that our parents talked about the Great Depression, or think about Studs Terkel writing about it, or the Stanford historian David Kennedy, or even Doris Kearns Goodwin, No Ordinary Time, which is about the letters that Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt received from people. There was enormous sense of community, place by place, state by state, town by town. I can remember my mother talking about my grandmother feeding hobos on the back porch and how...
The word hobo, that's
yeah, right. That's my grandmother's word, right?
Depression.
But think
too.
About, there was a real sense of community. And it was partly based on the lack of opportunity that didn't give vent to all that restlessness. And people still today, alive today, will say, yes, we knew our neighbors, right? Partly because we stayed put because we couldn't afford to go anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Yes, we went to the movies for a dime a ticket, by the way, in per capita terms, 9 times more than we do today, looking for a little bit of escape. We may have drunk a little more because we always drink a little more in downtimes, but there was a sense of community. There was a sense of all in it together. There was a sense of neighborliness. And if you go to the second article, right, about families being in some sense economically pressed to live together.
The multi-generational family,
right, back to the pre-industrial age, incidentally. There's that kind of solidity that comes with that too. Yes, it's fraught with tensions. Yes, you have to get along with grandma, et cetera. But there is a real asset side to this balance sheet. And I think it's exactly where you're going, Jim, around community, around stability, around a sense of what are we and what do we have when we have less access to more stuff and more money. I'm not trying to justify the economic recession. I'm trying to say there's always an underbelly, and sometimes that underbelly doesn't look so bad.
But you know the old joke, and it's less true about California because, you know, it's been around longer and people have been populated there for a longer time, but the country, you know, tilted and all the nuts rolled west. And I think one of the things about California, and you've lived there and so have I, that's very disconcerting is it is rootless. It is rootless, and everybody's from someplace else. And I found that really strange in the time I've spent living in California, which isn't that long, about 5 years all told, but I thought it was weird.
Yeah, and there's still that sense. I mean, think about San Francisco, right? Think about what we've been talking about in this program and what the media is writing about around inequality in San Francisco and the transition, right? Rent-controlled apartments that are now expensive condos, people that have lived there for generations being pushed out. All that creative destruction of capitalism, which often generates big increases in GDP, right, also has social costs to it. Right, not just what Schumpeter called transaction costs, social costs. So just and in the same way that where we're headed is there is you know some real day to day social, if you will, I'm being overly technical, social capital built and created in the connections that we form. Sometimes initially through economic exigency.
Well, you know, speaking of economic exigency, part of these stories about these multi-generational families when up until this time everybody's goal was to not only get their own house but get away from the parents or the grandparents. Culturally, there are lots of parts of the world where this is not a function of an economy. Yeah. It's a function of this is how we relate to the people around us. Yeah. We all stay together for our lifetimes, and then we're replaced by another generation.
Right.
And another. But it is the notion of the three-decker with no tenants anymore, but on the other two units, but your grandparents and your parents, is that almost totally a function in 2013 of the economy and people just needing, they need the grandparents there to take care of the kids for free. They, and all the things that flow from that.
So, and boomerang kids. Let's not forget boomerang kids, right? That's
yeah. one of my other favorite expressions of all
time. Jim is very hostile toward the boomerang kids.
But so I think it begins, right?
Does everybody know what they are? For those who don't know, boomerang kid is the kid that goes to college or goes away, gets a job, can't afford to live by him or herself, or likes their mother doing their laundry while they live in the basement. They come home, thus the boomerang. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I think it's a very important explanation. And I think that... That you know, probably in most of the cases that we're talking about, and this is not true unequivocally at all, right? It's like, you know, Art Kaplan saying, I'd hesitate to, you know, kind of write a prescription about all doctors like this. But this isn't true in all cases necessarily. But a lot, initially, there's often an economic, financial, you know, just literally weekly incomings and outgoings kind of reason to mush together. But then you start thinking about, this very interesting article called Together Again by Constance Rosenblum in the Times a couple days ago, talking about how, you know, a woman with a child, she's not living with the father of her child, moves in with her parents. So the little girl grows up knowing her grandparents.
Yes.
Well, it turns out to have all kinds of benefits they hadn't really completely thought through, like the granddaughter gets to know her grandparents. The active daughter gets to be active in helping, right, her father and her mother, who are now in their 60s, right? Mother, the middle generation, mom feels great because she can leave her child to go to two jobs she needs to have, right, like so many people, two jobs, and have trusted daycare. So... And still, money changes hands. This isn't the pre-industrial economy because the daughter pays her parents part of the rent. So, you know, I think a lot of what happens initially is economics, literally, you know, how much money's coming in, how much money's going on. But then all these, you know, if you will, as the economists say, positive externalities, real spillover effects, not only in terms of practical arrangements and the day-to-day, you know, the day-to-day things we have to do to live, but also in terms of, like, how we come to understand ourselves in relation to others. So bully for that.
Yeah. And also,
this is Nancy Kane, by the way, from Harvard Business School, for those who are not aware.
You know, and you would take it from a historical perspective that I don't know about, but it just seems that many kids do really well when their grandparents are nearby, if not in the same house, because a lot of the tensions they have with their parents are gone. And it makes for a more nurturing environment.
So let's go back to like the Lower East Side in 1910, right? We have all come over. We're three or four generations of a family from Eastern Europe. We're Jewish, and we're going to live in a large apartment. Right. Tanta is going to be with us. Right. Maybe a nephew or niece is going to be with us. And we're all going to benefit in the same way pre-industrial societies lived. And historians like Jan de Vries and Fernand Braudel have written about the French. Historians have written about this. Jan de Vries is Dutch, I might add, but have written about this in very, very interesting ways. In the same way that was, again, forced on society for survival reasons, there were all these benefits. Like kids had lots of different role models.
Right.
And there was lots and lots of different kinds of activity and learning cross-generational up and down or from older to younger and from younger to older that could happen, not to mention how you literally pass the football of caring and hunting and gathering, so to speak, around a bunch of people. And there were really big benefits to that, right? We went into a very modern kind of shoot, right, for 40 or 50 years where our ideas in this society – And to a certain extent in other parts of the world, industrial parts of the world, where we need to have our own place, right? And all the accoutrement and all the independence and, you know, bowling alone, right? As Robert, as one of those really interesting, Bob Putnam's book from Harvard puts it. And we could be alone, as David Foster Wallace has said, you know, with our technology in our own skull-sized kingdoms at the center of creation. Well, and I'm over-dramatizing, but, you know, we are being forced to calibrate backwards or over back again to the middle. I'm not sure it's such a bad thing. I think there's a lot of the economic prosperity and technological enamorment that we have lived with for the last 20 years that, regardless of, in the wake of very unequal distribution, that has chipped away, like Michelangelo chipping endlessly away at the Pietà, one of his Pietas, at our humanity. And here we are, forced to kind of live in it.
Well, speaking of going back...
For good and bad, but forced to deal with
it. Speaking of going back in time, before you go, I want to broach something that I just love, which is the advent of a reoccurrence of haggling as a way of doing business in America. I've been to China a handful of times because my kids are Chinese. People think when you talk about haggling in a different culture, they think about markets on the street.
Right.
You go to the biggest department stores in Beijing, and the expectation is when you look at the watch that's in the cabinet or anything else, you're going to haggle with them. They're going to say it's going to cost 100 whatever, and you say, I'll offer you 10. And you now, in American society, that's been almost a no-no.
Right.
But it's returning. The door was first cracked open when retailers said, well, we'll match the best price you could find, sort of a backdoor way of haggling. But the whole notion of going somewhere into a traditional environment where you pay the sticker price or you say no is beginning to disappear. No, why is that?
Okay,
I love it.
It's very interesting. So all you shoppers out there, you have a week left to start haggling.
Yeah, exactly.
Am I overstating
this? No, you're not at all. You're not at all. So let's just kind of take a deep breath and remember what I think was the big, if you will, kind of elephant breaching the gate or the barbarian at the gate here. I think it was eBay that began this in a lot of ways.
It's a very good point. Yeah.
Right? It taught us to rediscover. I mean, if you didn't like shopping for a newer used car, so you hadn't really discovered your kind of Middle Eastern bazaar inner child, right? Rug bazaar inner child. I can bargain well. Well, eBay helped you learn how to do that with their online auction system. I think that really set a little bit of a fire, you know, burning inside consumers.
By the way, when you mentioned cars, though, Consumer Reports also helped. When Consumer Reports started having that thing where you type in the car you want, they give you the list price, what it actually costs the dealer, and as scared as you were, you go to the dealer and hand them the printout, and they say, okay, I'm going to charge you $200 on top of that. That was a critical moment,
huge. So
too.
That's the lighter – what you're talking about is the lighter fluid on the fire, which is this incredible dissemination through, again, digital technology and our smartphones now, but our computers too, that really enabled consumers to have access to all kinds of information they never had before, right? So now you can walk into a store, and you know this very interesting article yesterday on the front page of the Times by Hillary Stout talks about this, where you can walk into a Best Buy, get on your smartphone, find out who else is matching this price, and then say to the sales clerk, man or woman, you know, I want this flat screen TV for what, you know, this retailer has it, and guess what, 10-1 or 8-1, that person is going to say, okay, ma'am. You got it.
Do you see that satisfied look on Marjorie Egan's face?
Yeah,
Nancy
she's got a Cheshire Cat smile.
Tell us. You don't have to keep it back. Tell us what you did a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, we're ready.
Which is not part of your usual character, Marjorie.
I was stunned that I did this. I have an old car. I went to a dealership.
A very high profile dealership.
He told me it was going to cost me $2,000 to fix the car. I said, $2,000? So I called some mechanics and got the prices for the new radiator and the new whatever. And it was unbelievable. I called back and I said, I'm not going to pay $2,000. They told me it would cost $1,300.
By the way, I told Marjorie not to waste her time, that they were never going to bring the price down. What happened?
He came down to $1,700. I said, well, they told me $1,300. He said, $1,500. I said, okay, I'll take it. No, $1,400. I get $600 off the price. I was stunned.
So is that a function of the fact, either the state of the economy, or is it a function of the fact that in the old days, even 15 years ago, old days, we didn't have the ability to do comparison shopping like you now described, and as a result, they could BS us, which they now can't quite do nearly as easily.
I think it's less a function of economic hard times or a slowly growing economy than it is of consumers discovering their inner bargaining power. I really do. And now the article goes on to state, and I know a little bit about this from my research, retailers are now training salespeople in places like Nordstrom's to bargain with people.
How great is that? Because they know it's going to happen.
So, you know, when you walk into Lord & Taylor and you want to buy some jewelry for a loved one, you can say, you know, actually, I can get that at this price at Zales. And guess what? You're probably going to get it for the lower price at Lord & Taylor's. So I think it's a lot about consumers discovering the power. And come on, there has always been. Women have now really embraced this as well as men, a hunting and gathering aspect to all this.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is the thrill of the chase.
It is. And by the way, is there anything more satisfying, Marjorie, than winning that chase like you did?
No,
with that
I was walking on air for about a week.
She called me about 12 times. Now, before you go, ordinarily, and I have a question for you, Nancy Cain, about your thought process. Ordinarily, you bring us cookies that you have baked. You bought us a chocolate pie. I'll get to that in a couple of seconds. Today, you departed from the, I guess we could call, the sweet end of things and moved to the savory end of things. And so I have two questions for you. One, why? And two, there is word on the street that there is this person by the name of Lee Kennan.
Yeah.
Who is the person behind some sort of secret sauce or something. Is that person have anything to do with this,
so whoever Kennan that person is? And Nancy Miley are two dear women in my life that help me keep the dogs walked and the counters
cleaned.
So
we should be thanking them instead
of you?
We just need to
sprinkle the gratitude across a number of people here.
Okay.
We really do. So the savory basket was just to mix it up for a little variety because we had a lot of sugar. So this is just a little basket, including some Starbucks coffee because I think the world can never have too much Christmas blend and mocha.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some like bread and cheese and nuts.
Can I explain something to you? And I feel weird doing this considering you were a scholar, you're an historian, you're a professor, all this stuff.
I actually put this together.
When you come to a radio show, we're supposed to give you something.
Yeah, we are.
As opposed to you giving us something.
Job.
You are doing us. Hey, Nancy Kane and all of your advisors and friends, thank you so much. And we'll see you in a week.
Always a pleasure.
Oh, I love a pleasure is mutual, Nancy Kane, historian of the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. And her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Okay. You may have noticed that it's snowing out. We're in the throes of winter, and when the construction cones, garbage cans, and lawn chairs are out in the street, sending messages to other drivers that space has already been taken. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of parking space savers and ice on people's sidewalks. The etiquette involved up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Okay, snow a couple of days ago, snow again this afternoon. The snowstorm tradition of parking space savers made its seasonal debut with this first snowstorm. People rolled out chairs. You've seen the photographs. I love this.
Yes.
Toilets, trash cans, ironing boards to save their freshly shoveled parking space. However, city officials in Boston warned that because there was no parking ban or snow emergency, objects left on the street were considered trash and hauled away. Well, that led to a crisis. Well, but while cones were everywhere, so was ice and snow on sidewalks outside businesses and homes. And we want to know briefly here, we only have a few minutes at 877-301-8970, how hard should we come down on those non-shoveling scofflaws? Is it a problem in your neighborhood? It's been a problem everywhere I've been since the first snow fell. And what do you do about it? There are fines in the city. A couple hundred dollars for a business if you don't comply with the rules about how fast you have to get rid of the snow and ice. At residences, the first offense, I think, is $100. I have to say, it's not the biggest issue in the world, but it's really high on my aggravation list when people don't take seriously their obligation to deal with this thing. Are you in the same spot or no?
Well, the thing that kills me, because I live on a hill, is people that might shovel, but then they leave this glaze of ice. So you're out walking the dog or walking to the tee or wherever you're walking, and you basically could slide right down the hill.
It's horrible.
And if you're an older person it's you don't like to fall on the ice, on the concrete. It kind of hurts. So I'm kind of upset at some of my neighbors who haven't put down the salt now.
What do you
do if
they
have? Salt is bad for the environment. It's bad for the
dogs.
Well,
they can buy something else.
You're supposed to get sand or the environmentally safe salt, but so you're not sliding down the street.
Listen to this. Here's Boston. This is fairly typical. It's not exactly the same. This is the regulation. Remove snow, slush, and ice from sidewalks and curb ramps abutting your property within 3 hours of snowfall ending or 3 hours from sunrise if the snow falls overnight. It's got to be at least 42 inches wide. And I have to say, when I said a minute ago, what do you do with the problem? When I did the thing on my sidewalk, I didn't do it wide enough this year. And I feel bad about it because you got to do it. And someone left me a very nice non-hostile note saying it was a couple of inches too narrow for wheelchairs and that sort of thing. And I went out and did it. And I felt pretty horrible about it. But it isn't like they yelled at me. They didn't egg my house. They didn't report me to
the snow?
Sort of. And I not sort of. And I you know what I'm really good at?
Wow.
Throwing the safe, it's not called salt. Whatever the safe salt is you get at Home Depot or whatever it is. I'm good at that. But we want to know.
Very good at that.
Does it drive you as crazy as I know it drives me and Marjorie when people don't take this
so
basic responsibility?
You're a sprinkler, not a shoveler.
I'm a boat. You know what I love, I have to say?
What?
I love the ice chipper. Do you know the thing? The manual chipper is when the ice forms and you hit it really hard and it breaks apart.
Yeah, I saw people out on Beacon Street yesterday because they hadn't shoveled out their cars. They were out there with garden hose.
Can I tell you something? And here are the fines. I want to say it one more time because this really drives me out. Failure to remove snow ice from sidewalk. Again, every city or town is different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you're a commercial property, first offense, $200 in Boston. And if you're residential, $100. And you know what my attitude is?
What?
It's not enough. It is not. I'm serious. This, you can cause serious injury to tons of people, real accidents, real problems.
Well, you know, if you've lived in a neighborhood long enough, you know who the people are that are really vigilant about their sidewalks and their stairs. I have a neighbor across the street from me. He's out there, you know, for 12 hours. He has got the most pristine steps.
They catch the flakes as they come down.
Yeah, he's out there. He's like, you know, got the outfit on. He's shoveling away. He's a great guy, actually. And then you have other neighbors that will go unnamed that just don't shovel.
So what do you do about that?
All.
That's the issue. Beyond the problem, and we know you.
Nothing.
You
wanna, I'm a big wuss.
You don't
I just
say
take
anything
it.
To them?
No, I do not.
You don't glare at them?
Well, sometimes you're worried if you glare at them that, you know, there might be repercussions. You know what I'm saying?
No, but
they might be a little unhinged. You know what I mean?
Let's take a few phone calls on this. 877-301-8970. This is purely to feed our personal angst over this issue because it really is a big deal. And it's going to be a problem tonight. It's going to start snowing this afternoon. It's going to snow for a handful of hours. Tomorrow we're going to wake up with more ice, more snow. You got to take this seriously. Let's go to Cambridge where Alyssa is on the phone. Alyssa, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
I was telling the person I talked to the story about when I first got a car.
Yeah.
I was living in Dorchester down near JFK Station, and I didn't want to participate in this chair saving. I thought it wasn't community spirit. I didn't put the chair out, and it snowed, and I'd come home and dig out a spot, and it would snow, and I'd come home and dig out a spot.
Oh.
Went on and on. So finally, one morning, I was exhausted. It was snowing. And I went inside and I dragged out the crappiest chair I could find. I went to work. I got home. There was a spot right near my house. As I'm pulling in, I hear a window snap open across the street. And the woman across sticks her head out and it's still snowing. And she shouts down at me. She goes, "We was wondering when you were going to figure it out about the chair."
That well, is one great story,
but you're
Alyssa.
Entitled,
thanks.
Right?
That is
I mean,
great.
They do
that
give
is
you
great.
What is it? Is it a 24 or 48 hour grace period in Boston?
I think it's 48.
Yeah, and really, you're out there for 2 hours trying to shoveling out your spot, and then some 18 year old from down the street sneaks into your spot. I mean, forget about that.
If I'm not wrong about this, did you not ask?
I did.
We did the second debate, the Walsh-Connolly debate, and while I'm dealing with these huge policy issues, Marjorie's dealing with things on the ground,
very
literally and
important.
Figuratively. Well, here is well, then candidate, now mayor-elect Marty Walsh, on the whole space saver policy that Alyssa was talking about. Here's Marty.
It depends on the storm. If it was the last storm we had last year, I would say, you know, 2 or 3 days, depending on the storm. Some of these, the city of Boston, in the last storm we had mountains of snow that turned into mountains of ice. And, you know, when people were out there working hard and we had, you know, 4 or 5 feet of snow on certain sides of the street, it depends on the snowstorm.
I would say that was the answer that got this guy elected. Most
absolutely. And in their defense, both of them have driveways. John Connolly, who ran and lost, and Marty Walsh, who ran and won, they both have driveways. But he lives in a street. I've been spying on all the candidates and where they lived, you know,
fine.
During the mayoral
They're
race.
Public figures.
And Marty Walsh lives in a very congested area. So he understands. I mean, parking spaces are a big deal in Boston. Dare not.
Did you read the Globe story, by the way, about the person who parked a car in a space that had been saved? Was this in South Boston?
Big trouble.
What happened to their 4 tires?
Slashed.
I mean, you got to do what you got to do. We're not advocating vigilanteism. But
no, you're not.
You should not be surprised if you go with what is common policy. Let's go to East Boston. Jake is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi, Jake.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
I want to talk about, I guess, pedestrian rights.
Mm-hmm.
I live here on my boat, and I don't have a car, and it's really hard to walk around, not only East Boston, downtown Boston, and it's because, okay, the main problem is that when there isn't a resident to shovel, then you get like a fence or something, and they nobody's responsible, apparently, so that it just doesn't get shoveled. Then the worst problem is that at the intersections, People shovel their sidewalks, but then the city plows come by and block them up again.
That's true.
Jake, you sound as aggravated as Marjorie and I. We want to go back to the beginning of your call. You live on a boat?
Oh, yeah.
Where?
Chelsea Creek.
And
between Chelsea and East Boston, in case you don't know.
Is it cold there? I mean, it must be kind of cold there in the wintertime, isn't it?
I love it.
You can pretty tell. So are there, what other than the, when you come on land or whatever the proper terminology is, are there special problems attendant to owning a boat in icy and snowy weather like we're having and about to have again?
Actually, it's easier.
Why?
Well, you shrink wrap your boat, you know, in the winter.
Okay.
Water. The snow just falls off into the water. So the marina takes care of plow, you know, shoveling off the docks. So basically, at your own home, you don't have any shoveling practically at all.
But isn't it hard breathing under the shrink wrap? Only kidding, Jake.
Well,
Jake,
it's not really all that tight.
You got know? It. Okay. Jake, thank you for bringing a different perspective
to
the discussion.
Wow, he lives in a shrink-wrapped boat.
Isn't there a piece of you that would love to live on a boat?
In the summertime.
In the summertime, yeah. Well, how great would that be?
It would be great in the summertime. I'm not sure.
You know
sure
that I'm a seafaring kind of person.
I know
so
you're
imagine.
A seafaring kind of
okay, let's move on.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk with Shira Springer. She's an investigative and enterprise reporter at the Boston Globe. She's going to talk about the guy that just won the Heisman Trophy, has a little legal problem hanging over his head, and also people getting hurt at football games. That's up next. Shira Springer from the Globe, 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to talk about all the ways sports and society intersect. Shira Springer. Shira is the investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Globe. She also contributed to the new book, Our Boston, Writers Celebrate the City They Love. All profits from the sale of books will go to the One Fund. Shira, great to see you.
Hi, Shira.
Good to see you. Hello.
So tell us about this quarterback from Florida State University, how do you pronounce his first name?
Jameis.
Jameis Winston. He just won the Heisman Trophy.
Football player in college football.
Yeah, great, great football player, no question about it. But he has got the charges were dropped involving this alleged rape, but the case is not going away exactly. Bring us up to speed on this.
Well, on December 7th, 2012, he allegedly sexually assaulted another Florida State student, a woman. And basically, from all reports, the police botched the investigation. They didn't really conduct a thorough investigation. It was believed because even though he was not yet starring for Florida State, he was there and, you know, sort of all the attention was on him already and there were great things expected of him and his status as a football player, soon to be football player for Florida State, they believe impacted the investigation. And then about a week before, 2 weeks before the Heisman Trophy Award ceremony, this resurfaces and there's a very quick investigation of what went on, and they decided not to charge him, and they hold this whole big press conference and basically make light of the whole situation.
We're going to play some sound from the state's attorney in that case. This guy's name is Willie Meigs in a second. But before you do, my understanding is that a lot of people who vote for the Heisman Trophy around the country had said, if this guy is indicted, or even if there's no decision, I'm not voting for him. Because I don't know if there's a morality clause in the voting, but there's something that says, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong, something about not just on the field, but what kind of person you are, that sort of thing.
Excellence and integrity.
Okay, those are the words?
Those are the words.
So the likelihood is good this guy would have not won the top honor that people like Doug Flutie won for being the best college football player. He probably would not have won,
Correct. Surely
if he was indicted, but likely not. Had this thing still been hanging
on.
There.
Correct.
Okay, so listen to this character. This is a compendium. It's not all. We can't play it all. This is Florida State's attorney, Willie Meigs. And during this press conference, which frankly, as far as I'm concerned, didn't even need to call. He could just put out a statement because they weren't going ahead with anything. He called this press conference to say there'll be no charges filed on these rape allegations. And as Shira said, it was 9 days before the Heisman Trophy was awarded. Just listen to this character.
Was there a sexual assault?
Well, that's kind of the... while we're here.
Come on.
You know, you ask kind of convoluted questions.
Any idea why she was hesitant to tell you who her boyfriend was?
Well, tell us about your girlfriend.
Is this guy getting signed? I mean, this is disgusting. And by the way, you know what's
laughing.
Almost as disgusting?
The reporters
is
laughing.
The fact that the reporters are... Exactly. I mean, this is appalling.
It's appalling. And it goes back even farther because the accuser's attorney says that there was a police detective that actually warned the woman not to pursue charges.
Why? Because this is a great football player.
Basically saying, you know how football is here in Tallahassee. It's a big deal. If you do this, you're going to be raked over the coals. Your life's going to be turned upside down. And this was before, this press conference and while there should have been an investigation going on.
And her life has been raked over the coals.
It has. I believe she's dropped out of Florida State because just the environment around there was so untenable. She just could not live and the stigma.
Let's give him the benefit of the doubt, which he probably doesn't deserve. But let's give Winston the benefit of the doubt. Let's say legitimately it was consensual sex, whatever it was. The behavior of this prosecutor is unconscionable. I mean, he's talking about sexual assault, rape, and even if he suggests that there was not a criminal act, I have a picture in front of him, a huge smile on his face as he's doing these things. He's laughing.
Kind of message does this send to every other woman? Never mind if they're pursuing charges against a football star. Every other woman out there who has been sexually assaulted and who is facing this type of scrutiny, what does this say to those women? It's his job to protect everyone, not just the reputation of this one star football player at Florida State.
Well, no, it's just very upsetting, and it underscores in a serious level, and this is in many cases so totally unfair, how hard it is for women to successfully prosecute rape cases. And it's really difficult, and when it's a situation like this where it's a he said, she said, and the police fall down on the job, I mean, it's amazing women come forward, frankly, when these situations happen.
Well, you both made a great point. I mean, you could be in California and watch this press conference on the evening news or on ESPN, and you got to say to yourself, this is every man. I mean, this is every prosecutor. I'm not going to go through this ridicule. Forget what you have to go through in the courtroom. Can we bring this back home a little bit, because it's too depressing to me to end this show? Well, this is actually pretty depressing, too. There is a contention based upon some recent events, including people falling out of stands on top of other people, which is surreal.
It's unbelievable.
That it's a more dangerous experience. Now, we know it's more dangerous for the athletes these days. We all know about concussions and those sort of things, talking about a lot. Is it more dangerous for the fan in 2013 who just goes to watch an event than it used to be?
I think it might be. I think that fans are more boisterous. I think there is potentially more alcohol being consumed. I mean, you used to see these old pictures of people at, let's say, Fenway Park, and they're dressed. They got their hat on and they're – I mean, it was a big day out and they're dressed up, and it's a much different atmosphere these days at stadiums and ballparks where it's about getting drunk. It's about going a little bit crazy. And then there are so many other aggravations that pile onto it. I think one of the most recent incidents happened in Denver, where there were three stabbings in the parking lot after a Denver Broncos game because of how some guy pulled out of his parking spot. So I think
crazy.
I think they're all.
Were the stabbers drunk or on drugs, or what was the deal?
Unclear. What the situation?
Been tailgating for 24 hours.
Yeah. I was going to say they've been tailgating for several hours at that point. It was a Thursday night game. Why this? One of the attackers came to the game with a fixed blade knife and a sheath in his belt, I'm not exactly sure. But
you've had a good experience. We used to have a listener at our former radio station who occasionally would share tickets with you.
That's right. I'd buy tickets from him, and his tickets were in the family section of Gillette. And it
was for the Patriots,
because I would go with my kids when they were younger, and nobody was drinking in the family section at Gillette.
Because you can't.
And the reason I loved it is because I had been there once before where there was this really drunk guy. And they eventually did take him out for the half hour before they took him out. He's swearing. It's, just gross stuff coming out of his mouth. And he's teetering in the middle of the aisle. And he was a huge guy. And all you could think about, he could fall right on top of you or fall on top of your kids. And, he had another one of these games with the Buffalo Bills where somebody actually fell 30 feet. I don't know if he was drinking, but he...
One would think he was. The sad thing was that he was lightly injured because the guy who broke his fall suffered a severe head injury.
Yeah, the guy landed on his neck.
Yeah.
From an upper deck.
They should have more family sections, it seems to me, in some of these
And probably
stadiums.
More policing of alcohol. I mean, I know nobody likes the cutoffs, but that may be a solution that these teams have to look into.
Well, it's interesting you say that. At the same time that we're all shaking our heads when you're saying, Shira Springer from the Globe, that they should police these better and if anything, contract one's rights. The Boston Licensing Board just last week approved a request from the Red Sox, which, by the way, was supported by Tom Menino, to not only expand the number of places, I don't have any problem with this, in the stadium where you can buy liquor. I mean, it's, if it's available, it should be available without having to stand in long lines. And that was Menino's point, I should say. But the more interesting part is you are now under the current rules. You can sell alcohol until the end of the seventh inning. And the theory is in the two final innings, you're going to sober up a little bit. Well, the new rules are, the old rules were the cutoff was either 2.5 hours from the first pitch or the end of the seventh inning. And since these games are so interminably long, the 2.5 hours almost always came first. Well, they've dumped the 2.5 hours. It's now only the end of the seventh inning, which even the Red Sox and observers say means you'll have more time to lube up, as Tom Brady once said,
lube up.
And then had to retract, which I think was a fairly innocent comment. Why are they going in the opposite direction that responsible people are saying fans and their families should be gone in?
I can only think it is a financial motive, just more the ability to sell more beer during a game. I mean, it certainly doesn't make any sense from a fan safety standpoint. And I have to wonder that once games start, if, you know, there are a couple of incidents post-game or at the end of games, if they revert back to the 2.5 hour policy.
And by the way, it's not just the end of the seventh inning thing. Now, one of the things that is totally aggravating is when you buy a beer at Fenway, they have to pour it in a plastic cup and you have to wait. Well, to speed things up again, they will now have certain aluminum cans and plastic beer containers, which will allow there to be much faster movement. So the good news is that you can move through lines much more quickly. The bad news is you can drink much more before that cutoff occurs.
Moving more quickly means more beer for more people.
Well, exactly.
I wonder what the difference is, if there is one, in the Lucchino, John Henry, Tom Werner ownership of the Red Sox. I do remember stories going back 15 years or so about the inflatable dolls being passed around in the bleachers and people being sick in the bleachers and things. Just, it was a lot cheaper for seats in the bleachers then, too. I don't hear about that anymore. Is it I'm just missing it? Or
I don't hear about that
up.
Either. I mean, I you know, used to hear about kind of a very rowdy crowd, and you were sort of warned if you get bleacher seats, beware of this kind of behavior. I would say you're about right with your timeline. About the last eight to ten years,
yes,
it seems to have calmed down, and it may, in large part, be because, you know, some of them, you know, some people can only afford bleacher seats, and even though the cost of bleacher seats have gone up, it's some of the crowd that might have been, let's say, out in right field, you know, more toward home plate is
right
now kind of migrating out toward the bleacher seats.
Yeah. Well, you don't get that thing of like the 15 college kids all together that you used to get, you know, before the Red Sox started winning so much, and
no,
things would kind of get out of hand.
Because no one can afford to go anymore.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, so that's one of the – we only have 2 minutes left, but you wrote a piece that I just want to touch on briefly. We've spoken to Chris Nowinski repeatedly, who really was one of the people that's a former pro wrestler, former Harvard football player, who really started with Dr. Robert Cantu at BU, this thing that I think is going to create great things on the concussion front. You wrote a piece about, I don't know if I pronounce it, McKelly,
mm-hmm,
Center, this thing in Waltham, it's working to reduce injuries for young athletes, which obviously they're focused on too. Quickly, what are they doing and how hopeful are people?
So right now they're, you know, going with existing protocols and trying to train athletes. You know, for concussions, it's about neck strengthening. It's about trying to figure out better ways to improve an athlete's agility so they can avoid collisions on the ice or on the football field or on the soccer field. But what they hope to do in the near future, and they're already starting this, is devise a number of studies for athletes, young kids as young as 4 and 5, to determine why they get injured and what they can do to prevent injuries. It's primarily concussions, ACL, tears, those types of prevalent injuries. And the hope is that in the next decade, the research coming out of the McKelly Center and new protocols developed as a result of this research can reduce the injury rate in young athletes, athletes in elementary school, high school, junior high school, by half.
So can parents just call this joint and call this place and say, can you see my kid, and the answer, or admit him or her into some program, and they can, assuming they can wait, can they get into this thing?
Right. So it doesn't accept insurance, but you can call up the McKelly Center and say, hey, listen, I would like you to take a look at my 7-year-old hockey playing
son.
Why
does it not accept? This drives me nuts. Why do they not accept? I mean, generally, when people don't accept, I don't mean to indict them because I don't know them. When doctors don't accept insurance, the goal is to screen out low and moderate income people. Is that what's going on here?
No, it's not.
Okay.
In fact, they do have a scholarship fund.
Oh, okay.
So that if kids can't afford it, they do want to try to accept as many athletes as they can. across as broad an economic range as they can. But the issue is that they actually have to get money in to keep the center up and running at this point.
And you quote Dr. Cantor, who everybody respects from the Sports Legacy Institute at BU, as someone who said he's very hopeful that this is actually going to result in something good over the next decade.
He's hoping, and I think a lot of sports medicine doctors are sort of hoping for a sea change where you don't just think about treating injuries, but you begin to think about how you're going to prevent injuries.
It's huge. I mean, it's just totally huge. We all focus on the Wes Welker concussions and everything else. When kids are getting concussions, I'm pointing to Mark. It's a real serious thing. Shira Springer, thanks as always. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Shira Springer is the investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. She also contributed to the new book, Our Boston Writers Celebrate the City They Love, and all proceeds or profits from the sale of that book will go to the One Fund for the Marathon Survivors. Shira, again, thanks for being here, and thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney's here tomorrow. Her list is going to be a little early this week. We're also going to talk with writer Corby Cummer, his list of the great cookbooks of the year. I am Marjorie Egan.
Well, let's not forget her boss is going to be here tomorrow, too. Brian McGrory is going to
join us,
right?
Oh, I forgot about Brian McGrory. Yep, Brian McGrory is going to be here, too.
And I am Jim Browdy.
See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.